Hello and welcome to Law Pod with me, Rosie Cowan. I'm a lecturer here in the School of Law, and in this episode, I'm delighted to welcome two colleagues and experts on the law around death and will making, Professor Heather Conway and Barrister Sheena Grattan, to discuss the fascinating topic of dying tidily. They say that death and taxes are life's only certainties, and there's been a lot of talk recently about the Swedish concept of death cleaning, preparing mentally and physically for death. Setting your financial affairs in order is important, not only to ease the burden on your loved ones, but also to ensure that your worldly goods go to those you wish to receive them. So a vital practical step that we should all take is to make a will. Now, in Northern Ireland, we don't have to make a will, do we, Heather?
That's right, Rosie. No one is obliged to. It would be really good if a lot of people did, but there's no legal requirement to make a will.
And can I ask roughly how many people in Northern Ireland actually die without having made a will?
It's very difficult to get the precise statistics, but most of the estimates is that it's definitely more than half, and it could be as many as 60%.
Thank you, Sheena. And why do you think, either of you, why do you think are people so reluctant to make a will?
I think it's sometimes, Rosie, people don't actually want to think about making a will. There's almost a superstition element to it. You know, they will thinking that if I make a will, I might die. Well, we can all see the problem with that. There may be a sense of procrastination and postponing, and I'll get round to it at some stage, and I'll do that at some time. I think there might also be mistaken belief about costs and how much it actually costs to make a will. Maybe Sheena could speak a little bit more to that.
Yes, I think that generally the public, maybe when they hear lawyers, they assume it's going to be very expensive. Making a will, I understand from my colleagues in the solicitor's profession, currently on average for a relatively simple will, and would be £150 to £200. So it's not as maybe expensive as people think.
Not prohibitive. But there are other ways of making a will rather than going through a solicitor. Sheena, could you maybe talk us through those and what the pros and cons of them are?
Yes. First, you're free to make your own will. You don't need any assistance whatsoever. However, Northern Ireland has no discretion or concession. If you choose to do that, you still have to comply with quite strict formalities. To assist you to do that, you could, in the old days, it was a DIY will kit bought from a stationer's office. Those still exist, but are generally you're more likely to find online wills. My own personal view, and I've no axe to grind here because I'm not a solicitor, and my own personal view is that it is much better to go to a solicitor. There are other professional will writers. Some are better than others. However, that profession is not regulated. And there have been some horror stories arising out of wills prepared by professional will drafters that are not solicitors. My practice when I was, I'm now a retired barrister, when I was practicing, a lot of my practice in wills actually arose out of badly drafted homemade wills. Even Martin Lewis, who has been very active in promoting getting your affairs in order, he agrees that a solicitor will is the gold standard.
Okay, and when we were chatting before the show, you said that actually solicitors have a lot of experience administering estates, so they will maybe see the pitfalls more easily than a layperson.
Yes, that's correct. Some of the will drafters, some of them are good. Some are insured. Some unfortunately are not. But I think what sets the solicitor apart, usually with the practice of drafting wills, you also deal with the administration of an estate thereafter. And there's nothing to beat the experience of administering complex estates when you're actually drafting. You need significant foresight when you're drafting wills to deal with reasonably foreseeable consequences. And I think that's probably where the solicitor's profession has an edge.
And just then, what are some of the problems and issues that arise, both with, well, firstly, as you said, we don't like to think about these things in many cases, but funeral arrangements and then distribution of property if a person hasn't made any provisions for those or talked about those to their family.
Another problem in this area, Rosie, is that a lot of people assume, and this maybe ties in with the idea of why people don't make wills, they assume that certain people are going to inherit their property when they die. And likewise, maybe people have misplaced assumptions around funeral arrangements, and those assumptions don't always ring true. People maybe think that, oh, when I die, X is getting all my money anyway, or all my assets are going to pass to a certain individual. But that's not how it works from a legal perspective. And certainly that would be the case with both inheritance and with funeral arrangements. Sheena, I don't know if you want to come in on the inheritance point.
Yes. First of all, the intestacy rules are complicated. Survey after survey shows that the only people who really understand them in depth are the legal profession. Currently, HMRC Inheritance Tax Manual isn't accurate in relation to the intestacy rules in Northern Ireland. So that's the first point. The intestacy rules are supposed to reflect the intention of the average testator. In other words, they're supposed to represent the will you would make if you chose to make a will. But those rules have only been changed in very piecemeal respects since the 1950s. And society has obviously moved on bounds since then. In particular, if there's one point I think both Heather and I would like to emphasise, is there's no such thing as the common law spouse. Individuals who are not legally married or in a registered civil partnership have no rights whatsoever under the Northern Ireland Intestacy Code in 2024. Now, before your listeners panic too much, it may be that there is recourse to other types of remedy. They might be able to make a claim in the estate, but those are not automatic and they will cost a certain amount. So if nothing else comes out of this podcast, we're really at pains to point out that the common law spouse is a legal concept which does not exist. And I think at that point, I'll pass over to Heather, because I know in the funeral context that can cause particular issues when somebody dies without a will.
Absolutely, Sheena. The basic rule around funeral decision making, and this is something that does crop up in an awful lot of family examples. If I die and I have a valid will, my executor has the legal right to make my funeral arrangements. If I die and I don't have a valid will in place, and as Sheena has already alluded to, that's possibly the case for most of the population here in Northern Ireland, then who has the right to make my funeral arrangements? Well, it's my spouse, my children, my parents, and then we go through other family members. Unmarried cohabitants are not in there at all. So you could reach a situation whereby a couple have been in a long-term cohabiting arrangement or relationship, one of them dies, and someone else in the family wants to make the deceased funeral arrangement. The long-term cohabiting partner has no legal say in the funeral.
Very important point. And just on the point there of executors, can you just explain that term for anyone who might not be familiar with it? What, you know, that you have to appoint executors for your will?
Yes, well, maybe better start with the umbrella term of a personal representative. When someone dies, Northern Ireland legal system, like most of the common law world, appoint somebody essentially in your place to administer the estate. If you appoint the individual or individuals in your will, the name is an executor. If you die without a will, the personal representative is called an administrator. So an executor is the individual appointed in a will to basically stand in your shoes and administer your estate. In practical terms, Rosie, that means that they bring in the assets, they pay the debts, and then they distribute the estate. In the will context, it would be in accordance with the terms of the will.
And what about then, you know, familiar with things that are inherited, like a house, like money. But what about possessions then? What kind of arrangement should we make around them? Can you leave anything in a will or everything?
Well, first of all, and I'll pass over to Heather later, but you cannot leave your body in a will. We'll come to funeral arrangements again. The reality, Rosie, is a lot of wealth still passes outside of the will or the intestacy rules. For example, I myself did not have a will until relatively recently, simply because, like all young people, or many young people, I was worth more dead than alive. And our house, I'm married, our house was held as joint tenants. So that would have passed automatically to my husband on my death outside of a will. And the only other wealth we had in the early years of our marriage was what our respective employers would have paid out under our death in service benefit. And that was separate to a will because that's done by way of a nomination. And the other thing I'd say to our listeners, it's very important that your nomination is kept up to date. There are other assets such as life insurance policies held in trust that pass outside the will. And in addition, the credit union, for example, that might be something known to your listeners, have a separate statutory nomination scheme whereby members can nominate accounts up to £10,000 to another individual. Again, that cannot be overridden by will. So whilst it's important to have a will, it doesn't deal with all of your assets.
Okay. And just on that point about where we store the paperwork for these arrangements, the will, and maybe there would be other important information that you would want people to know after you pass away, what kind of arrangement should we make around that?
Well, we entitled the podcast Dying Tidily. And that was actually a phrase I first encountered maybe 30 years ago when I was a much younger stage of my career. And it was from Which magazine. And the whole idea that we can think of the will and also another document that's important that we'll probably come on to, the power of attorney. But in my experience, in practice, so many people fail to actually address their paperwork. As they say, it may make sense to you. You're a really messy study. I have a very messy study myself, but it is vitally important that when we go, the people entrusted to look after our estate, being executor or even our family members, are aware where to find things. Another point on that, Rosie, I would like to highlight is so often in a household, one individual looks after all of the finances and the paperwork. Traditionally, it was very much in Northern Ireland, sort of the man of the house, but that's not exclusively the case. And as Martin Lewis, to borrow his phrase, it's very important that not one individual wears the financial trousers in the house. And he's recently been running a campaign to get family members to address what's going to happen when the other one passes away. So as obviously grief is such a huge issue, but it's made so much worse by not having your sort of practical affairs in order, which I say goes beyond making a will, to actually providing the documentation in a place, perhaps get a file where more important documents are kept. It's vitally important that those who'll be looking after your affairs know where to find things.
Absolutely. And just on that point of grief, and something that we do fairly quickly in Northern Ireland after death is arrange a funeral. And what kind of issues can that bring up if the deceased hasn't left clear instructions around that funeral and how they want it conducted and the arrangements they want made?
I think you've made a really good point here, Rosie, in the sense that there are so many issues around funerals, especially here in Northern Ireland, where custom dictates that we tend to have a burial or cremation within 3 days of the deceased's death. And obviously, because of that, you have a lot of decisions that need to be made within a fairly compressed time frame. And likewise, within families who are grieving and within families who may have had previous, how can I describe this, pressure points or points of friction within a family. And I think sometimes we always think that death unites families and brings them together, but we probably know from personal experience, and maybe in Sheena's case as well, from professional experience, that that is definitely not what happens. So I think personally, it's important to have a conversation in advance. Talk about what you want as your funeral arrangements. Now, from a legal perspective, does that matter? Well, people may be surprised to hear this, but your funeral instructions are not legally binding. So whoever survives you on death is not legally obliged to comply with your funeral instructions. But I think there's almost a sense of moral obligation if the deceased has made their wishes clear. But it also gives families a very clear reference point that if there's disagreement or uncertainty within a family about what a loved one wanted to happen on death, that you have a very clear steer. No, they wanted to be cremated. They didn't want to be buried. They wanted a non-religious ceremony instead of a religious one. So I think it's really important to have those conversations, to have some sort of frame of reference and to allow those decisions to be made in that compressed time frame. And also, you don't want to end up in the situation, and I have seen this from my own research, in which families absolutely refuse to budge on funeral arrangements and they end up in court litigating over who's going to have control of the funeral arrangements. And that's just going to add another layer of grief and uncertainty onto an already very complex family scenario.
I would agree with that, both in relation to the funeral instructions, but also more generally. My experience from my work dealing with contentious estates over the years is that while some estate disputes are motivated by greed, the vast number are actually motivated by something deeper than that and much more complex. And I'm not an expert in psychology. I don't think you need to be to work out what's going on at one level. So again, certainly myself and most of my professional colleagues would emphasize to our clients the importance of communication, communication, communication. People do not like surprises. Not only does it manifest itself at times with a row about the funeral, but often some children are left, maybe rightly or wrongly, with the impression or expectation that they'll inherit something in particular. And there's a whole raft of disputes on that topic. And not all of those disputes can be eliminated.
And of course, just following on from that point, Sheena, it's not just the big ticket items. I think you'd agree that it's not just the big ticket items that are a problem. It's those pieces of property, especially maybe parental wills leaving their estates to children. It's the property that has much more of a sentimental value than a financial worth that siblings can actually end up fighting over. And of course, you're not going to go through a will and itemise every single item of property that you have and which child is inheriting it. But a lot of literature and again, personal experience would suggest that sometimes siblings will fight over the smaller value items or the more sentimental items than the ones that have much more financial value attached to them. I actually heard of a family recently who the mother and father were both getting a little bit older and had three children, and they invited them all around one weekend and gave them a bunch of post-its and said, there you go, different coloured post-it packs. Take your post-it and decide who's getting what, because we don't want you fighting whenever we're no longer here. And unfortunately, both of them have passed away since that happened.
On the post-it theme, one of my instructing solicitors tells me that his funniest experience was when he was administering an estate and four siblings who didn't get on, and he gave them each a set of coloured stickers, one different colour for each one, and he followed them round the house with the clipboard, and all the items in the house either had four stickers or no stickers, because essentially the first child who put the sticker on, it was really sort of a red rag to the others to do likewise. And they all ended up being sold at auction, with the children apparently bidding against each other. As Heather was chatting, it brought back a mantra of the probate practitioner, which is really the heat generated by a probate dispute is inversely proportionate to the value of the asset involved. And I think what we're saying, that's definitely the case.
Very apt. It can really eat into an estate.
But here's the thing about these things, Rosie, is people should have the conversations beforehand, try to encourage, you know, people to think about these things and talk them over with their family. That's one of the points that we keep making repeatedly in this podcast.
Absolutely. And just when you mentioned on the topic of executors there, and if a will has two executors, you know, what kind of people should you appoint for that role?
Well, you do not need to appoint a professional. Essentially, you need to have trust in your executor. Ideally, they should be people with good common sense. Often in my practical experience, and many solicitors who draft wills tell me this, that parents are keen to appoint all of their children rather than make a distinction between them. And sometimes that comes along with the comment, well, they don't really get on with each other now, but this will force them to work together. My own experience shows that if people don't really gel during the lifetime of the parents, it's highly unlikely that in the emotional aftermath of death, they'll be able to work together well. So in that scenario, it might be better to have an independent person such as a solicitor as the executor.
And we think about these rows over wills and perhaps elderly parents passing away and adult children. But some people might think, well, I'm only in my 20s or my 30s, have plenty of time to think about these things and make a will, and maybe I don't own my own home or have much money. What would you say to them?
Well, I would say, Rosie, that it's never too early to make a will, notwithstanding my earlier observations that I didn't have one until relatively recently. That, however, wasn't a responsible decision in the sense that I'd worked out precisely what was happening. Again, one of the main reasons why people are maybe make a will for the first time in their lives is because they have had children and they're keen to appoint guardians. One of the things you can do with your will, as well as disposing of your property, is to appoint testamentary guardians. over the years, some of my most intractable family disputes, sadly, arose out of very young, premature, unexpected deaths, where the individual had not made a will, probably again, as you say, thinking I'm only in my 20s and my 30s, and just the family situation in many of those is complex enough. There may be an unmarried partner, there may be a minor child, and it would have been so much easier for all involved if there had been a will.
Absolutely. So with very tragic circumstances there. And a lot of people also worry about leaving a beloved pet. Children are one issue, but pets are another.
Well, I'll come in on that. As I understand, people asking solicitors questions more frequently and in the past. To get down to basics, your pet is property and it can be given to somebody. One way of making sure your cat's provided for is to leave your cat to a trusted individual, having communicate it with them in advance. Together, I suggest with a sum of money that's sufficient to maintain the cat's habits. Or if there's no suitable individuals, perhaps think of getting in touch with one of the animal charities in good time and see if they operate schemes where they undertake to rehome the animal.
I'll come in there as a beloved dog owner, Sheena, and I'll single out the Dogs Trust here as being one example of a charity that advertises quite proactively about, you know, they'll look after your pet whenever you're no longer around to look after it if you can't find someone else to do so.
Well, I'll come in for one of the funniest wills I ever encountered, Rosie, from the early years of my practice, and I won't say what part of Northern Ireland this occurred in, but testatrix, and that's the Latin for a female testator, and that maybe is relevant because she left her house to a certain feline charity that shall remain nameless, but on the understanding that it would leave her home to be provided as a residence for her cats whilst they still lived, and the charity was required to employ a carer to look after said cats. At one stage, I understand there were 31 in the house, and needless to say, the charity exercised its right to disclaim that particular gift in the will.
Disclaim, now that's interesting, because you were saying basically you can leave anything to anyone, but are there some restrictions around that?
Well, essentially nobody can be forced. The phrase in the case is, as you not so put something in against your teeth, no one can be forced to accept a gift in a will. You're free to disclaim it as long as you do so quickly enough. Actually, for tax reasons in practice, many gifts are disclaimed, but it was simply the charity felt that the obligation was too onerous upon it to be maintaining this house. Now, from a property law perspective, myself and Heather would maybe make the argument that that gift might have been not upheld, that in other words, the charity took it without any strings, but maybe for publicity or reputational reasons, the charity chose not to do that.
And just on that point on challenging a will, how common are challenges to wills and how do they arise?
Well, the one point it's 30 years that I've been dealing with wills on a professional basis, and probably the biggest change I've seen, Rosie, is and it's probably fair to use the word exponential, the exponential growth in will challenges of all sorts during my career. They take various forms. It can simply be that the will itself is invalid, and it's much more likely that your will be valid if it's made with a solicitor or a other reputable will maker. It may be that the will itself is valid, but certain individuals can challenge it, say because they are dependent and they haven't been left sufficient provision. Or it may be that what I was alluding to earlier about people being made promises, that promises have been made and the court feels that those promises are such that they should not be reneged on. It's complex enough. I suspect it may be that in the modern era, less weight is put on the sanctity of the will and of people's wishes. When I first started practicing, there was generally a view that nothing good came of someone who challenged a will, but I think maybe that idea has moved on. And another point, Rosie, the fact that houses have been out of the reach of many ordinary workers of late, if you look at the papers every weekend, you'll see that the money supplements make the point that eventually we'll have two divisions, those who have inherited money from their parents and those who haven't. So I suspect if children are disappointed, they're waiting for their inheritance in order to get themselves on the property market. And then when that doesn't transpire, they go to seek legal advice. Is there any way that we can set aside this will?
Yeah, and I think another reason, Rosie, just picking up on what Sheena has said, is that you see an increase in second families and blended families these days, and that creates new pressure points. So maybe the parent repartners, remarries, and leaves assets to the second spouse, and therefore the children are inheriting much less. Mm-hmm. Or you maybe have younger children from the second relationship compared to adult children from the first. That creates its own pressure point.
Absolutely.
And that sort of thing can map onto funeral disputes as well. And you often see that as being a trigger for a funeral dispute, the tension between a first family and a second family or within blended families these days.
Indeed, life has got more complicated. What then about someone with no close relatives or no obvious person to inherit? And what happens if they don't make a will? Where do their possessions go?
Well, the strict legal position, Rosie, if someone dies without any next of kin, their estate passes to the Crown as what's called bona facantia, vacant goods. Now, in Northern Ireland, there's no restriction placed on who is your next of kin. It's basically your nearest blood relative. So in theory, no one should actually die bona facantia. If the department of the Crown Solicitor's Office that deals with bona facantia get an estate, they generally advertise and try to find relatives. After people who are living together outside marriage or a registered civil partnership, I suggest another category of person who really is a priority to make a will is someone who has few or if any relatives, because when they pass on, a lot of their estate will be expended on heir locators trying to trace the next of kin, whereas they could choose to benefit individuals who've been good to them or charities, for example.
And is it true to say, Sheena, that in inheritance context, we're always caught up in kin and family, and people's living arrangements are changing quite a bit? In recent years, there are more people with you know, fewer family relatives, more people are living alone in single occupancy households. They're nearest and dearest, for want of a better expression, maybe close friends, as opposed to very distant family members, which tags on to the point that you've just made.
Yes, and the point I made at the very start about the intestacy laws lagging far behind societal conditions, which makes it even more important to make a will. It said the intestacy rules are a blunt tool. They were designed to be such, to be cheap and easy to administer. They worked fine in the 1950s, but they no longer work in the first quarter of this century.
Another kind of major change in society, people living to old age, but often incapacitated, maybe through dementia or a stroke, they may need to make arrangements while they're still alive for a relative to take care of their affairs. How should they go about that, and at what stage of an illness should they go about that?
Well, our law currently in Northern Ireland is different. I would make that point. And my solicitor colleagues, knowing I was doing this podcast, emphasised I make this point because apparently Martin Lewis in a recent programme suggested that a lasting power of attorney can be made in Northern Ireland. That's not the case. In Northern Ireland, it is possible to execute a document that appoints individuals of your choosing to manage your affairs in the event of you losing capacity. When I say affairs, it's property affairs. Not as in England, health and welfare issues. My own personal view is that it's vitally important that individuals make an enduring power of attorney when they have capacity. Again, Rosie, to go back to your earlier question, in their 20s and 30s, so many road accidents or people can have a stroke that immediately leaves the other party or the individuals who they want to access their accounts unable to do so. The enduring power of attorney does not have to come into effect until such time as you lose capacity, and it would be very important, in my opinion, that everybody... Martin Lewis makes the point that it's actually more important than making a will. I'm not sure I'd go that far, but it's certainly as important.
And how often should you review these arrangements? Because this is maybe not a one-off event that you make a will or make these arrangements for the future.
Our law, Rosie, operates on the basis that it's up to the citizen to both make the will and review it. Perhaps oddly, for some of your listeners, there are very few circumstances that have an impact on your will. One is remarriage or entering into a registered civil partnership that revokes a will. However, Having your first child, for example, does nothing to your existing arrangements.
Likewise, getting divorced or dissolving a civil partnership.
Getting divorced or dissolving a civil partnership doesn't revoke your will, but any gift in your will to your former spouse does fail, but it might not necessarily go where you want it to go. So in any of those milestones of life, Rosie, it's very important that people review their existing will. And my own rule of thumb, but it's just a very broad brush, is that people should consider reviewing their will every 5 years or so.
And just pardon the pun, but have you got any final message for our listeners today?
I think the one thing that we're stressing recurrently, Rosie, is the need to have these conversations. Part of the timing of this podcast is around Dying Matters Week. And it's really a week that encourages people to think about death, think about dying. They're not palatable subjects, but it's the inevitable lot of every single one of us. But have the conversations, get your paperwork in order, get your thoughts in order, and talk to the people who are closest to you in life about what you want to happen.
Yes, and I would echo again, there's no such thing as common law spouse, that people who are in a cohabitational relationship, not legally married, not in a registered civil partnership, really do have to address this issue as soon as they can.
Barrister Sheena Grattan, Professor Heather Conway, thank you very much.